try and learn how to match. It's actually a pretty good tool for learning how to match networks.
Now, let me run that by again. If I made a series of measurements on a good network analyzer or the AEA equivalent, I've got one of these antenna analyzers like the one that Mel's using, and I go to each of my favorite frequencies. Let's say, for instance, I'm trying to build an antenna to cover 144 to 148, and every quarter of a megacycle or so, I make a measurement of reflection coefficient and phase angle, which really is the raw data of S11. So now I've got a whole S11 data set. Is there a way I can plug that into BessrNet? Or conversely, if I know that my antenna at my favorite frequency, if I'm only matching one frequency at a time, if I happen to know it acts like a 40-ohm resistor in series with a 30-ohm capacitor, 30 ohms of capacitor reactant, if that's my antenna, can I plug that data into BessrNet, then plug in my samples of series and shunt capacitors, and it will tell me what the resultant impedance is, or plot it for me on the Smith chart? Is that sort of what it'll do for me, Steve? If so, that's a very valuable program. Back to you, Steve, and there is no beep before about 10:30.
Okay, I've only played around. I'm playing around with it right now. I'm trying to see if you can actually get the values. You actually, what you would do is, let's say I put a transmission line in, you would actually click on the thing that says transmission line, you know, it looks like a little piece of coax or whatever, and you drag your mouse and it shows you the direction it would go, but I'm trying to see if it actually gives you a value. I can't see that. It gives you all the, you know, the impedance circles and all the other, but I just don't see a way of getting a value out of this. Maybe there is.
Yeah, I guarantee there is a program somewhere that Mel and I and you would consider very valuable. Maybe it's an expensive thing you got to buy, but I'll bet you somewhere on the net, somebody has made a program, even though it may be a little bit user-hostile instead of user-friendly, somewhere there's a program where I can take my real antenna data. Like I said, it could be in the form of a 40-ohm resistor in series with a 30-ohm capacitor reactance. That may be my real antenna, which was Mel's sample last week. Or if I know that it is a 6 dB reflection at an angle of 30 degrees, or it's a 0.3 voltage reflection at an angle of 45 degrees. That kind of information. I mean, that's what real S11 reflection coefficient on a scattering matrix measuring instrumentation, good network analyzer, what it really is. And by the way, I'm also sort of amazed at what has happened. When I was working as an electronic engineer in roughly 1969, whenever you wanted to measure a component on the bench, you went over and got a signal generator. You went over and got some kind of a detector, maybe a diode detector and an oscilloscope, and you put it together. You applied the signal generator to the amplifier in the test. You took the output of the amplifier, put it into the crystal detector, put it onto the oscilloscope, and then maybe you set it up as a sweeper network and it set up a curve for you. You coupled the signal generator in the sweeper mode to the horizontal axis of the oscilloscope. All of a sudden, somebody came along and said, hey, I'm going to combine the signal generator and the receiver all in one package, and I'm going to measure the phase at the same time. When that was first mentioned to me as a piece of desirable test equipment in 1969, I remember saying, yeah, there's a certain number of people who will do that, but it's not the traditional approach. Most of us will keep using all the bench equipment we got. Here we are, 20-some-odd, 30-some-odd years later, everybody uses a network analyzer, and that's what a network analyzer is, a signal generator, a detector, a phase measurer, and a display, all inside of one box. Now we say, how the hell did we learn to live without them? Now that I use a network analyzer, it sits on my desk, and I use it for making antenna measurements every single day. I wonder now, how the hell did I live without it? I was in the dark ages. Thank you, Steve.
Studio.
EO recognized as Steve first. Go ahead, Steve.
Okay, if you want some pretty powerful software, and it's actually free, I would actually download the student version of Antsurf Designer. They actually have a student version that does a very nice linear simulation, and it does probably more than you need.
Okay, so the student version. I guess you have to flip a little bit and say that I'm a college student, and you get the practice version of Ansoft Designer, And I think you're saying if you go to the right website, it is free for a certain length of time. Is that the way it works, Steve?
I'm not saying it's free for a certain length of time. It's free forever. I have it on my computer here, along with Microwave Office. But I use Microwave Office a little bit more for simple things. And if I want to do maybe slightly more complex, I'll use Ansoff Designer. But no, it's actually free, and it's actually very useful.
Now, is Microwave Office an ARRL product? I know that American Radio Relay League has a kind of network modeling, network solution program. Is that the one that's called Microwave Office? Steve, go ahead.
No, Microwave Office is done by Advanced Wave Research or Applied Wave Research. I'm trying to remember the exact AWR. And I guess the program sells for, I don't know, about $25,000. But, you know, it's an easy-to-use program. If I want to do something real quick, I'll use that. Ansoff is nice because I can go to an EM simulation. I use that at work to go to HFSS or whatever. But, no, it's not done by ARRL. It's actually a professional package.
And it's only $25,000. The whole world is just going to run right out and get one of those, Steve. By the way, the number of people in the RF world who are skilled at putting data into HFSS, High Frequency Structure Simulator, seems to be very small. Like, I've got a particular problem where physical modeling of an electronic waveguide device is required. I've got this British telephone network made waveguide to coax adapter, where a very fancy coaxial high power traveling wave tube output round circuit is the exciting probe network for a piece of WR-75 waveguide. And the piece of WR-75 waveguide has got a couple of fancy tuning devices in it. And on three or four occasions, a number of so-called HFS experts have tried to model that network for me. That network is designed at 16 or 15 gigahertz, and it works very well there. But the piece of waveguide is good down to 9 gigahertz. I want to use the tube at 10 gigahertz. The tube has beautiful response at 10 gigahertz. But that waveguide, the coax adapter structure that's on the output of the traveling wave tube, just happens to be a dead short circuit at 10.368 gigahertz, my favorite frequency. I'd love to be able to use HFSS to find out what is going on and what have I got to modify to make it work at my frequency. All those fancy structures that are in there are used for the uplink control of group delay distortion for television signals. That's what the transmitter was originally designed for a 15 gigahertz uplink. And so are you one of those guys that has the skill of HFSS modeling and putting the data into the machine? Back to you, Steve.
Not to that degree. Normally I'll use that for a filter or something like that, similar to the ones you saw at that little talk they had at, what was it, Telephonics. Not to the degree where I can actually do 3D modeling that well. I can do it, but it would probably take me something like what you're describing. It would probably take me a month to do it or something. It's not that easy. It's actually pretty complicated to do that.
Oh boy, is it. And that's what we discovered. As I said, I've had a number of my friends try, and they all essentially gave up. Rich, N2EO, go right ahead with your statement, sir.
Okay, thank you. I was going to suggest that you get a very bad cold. Go on Google, type in online network analyzer, or network analyzer online. You might just come up with something that you can plug numbers into.
Are you speaking from experience, or are you speculating now, Rich? Go ahead.
Oh, I'm speculating, but I type stuff in like that and been very pleasantly surprised in the past. I don't know for sure. I'm not near a computer. If I was, I'd do it right now.
Okay, that's an extremely good suggestion. And by the way, whatever Google is today, it's getting better tomorrow. They're buying more and more software companies and whatever, adding more and more sophistication to their system. You go to Google and type in the right set of words. And by the way, you can buy books from Amazon.com, among other people, which will tell you how to get more out of Google. They'll give you hints as to how to put in the right words to get what you're looking for. A skilled person that can use a search engine, and there's a whole lot of search engines. Google is probably the most popular one, but there's four or five others, Dogpile, and I can't even think of the names of them, but there's a lot of search engines. You properly use a search engine, my goodness, is there a lot of data on the net these days. As a practicing engineer, I used to have 35 file drawers filled up with file folders of data and books and bookshelves in order to contain all of the books to tell me how to do it, the manufacturer's catalogs, and other handy hints of where I've torn articles out of electronic magazines. I had 35 file drawers in order to have the database to carry on my business. And every supervisor I had at every company department that I worked for would say, hey, you guys, you got to squeeze everything down to one file cabinet, six drawers. And I would find all kinds of ways of hiding all this information around the building. Because when I got rid of the information, I get rid of the raw data I needed to carry on my business. And then those exact same individuals, those supervisors, who told me, you got to get rid of all this stuff, whenever they needed a good reference book, I'm the guy they came to. And I kept pointing out to them that had I followed their orders and gotten rid of all this stuff, I wouldn't be able to do what I'm doing for them right now. I wouldn't be able to help them. They were all very short-sighted. Well, engineering has changed. A modern-day engineer, instead of having 35 file drawers and 5 bookcases, he now realizes that 90% of all the data he needs is on the Internet. He just has to figure out the right way to get it off the Internet. He's got to learn those techniques. And a hell of a lot of the bulk of the raw data I used to have to store is no longer required. The world has changed. It's time we adapt to it. And one of the guys who's adapting is Mel, K2KEY. Go ahead, Mel.
Automatic control operator change over.
Look out, we all got to wait for the beep from now on.
Okay, we're in a regular mode now. Yeah, that's true. Well, there was one article before I get to it, Les Besser, antenna bridge calculations. Pretty interesting. I remember hearing the whole spiel on it, which really, you know what it is? A lot of things, listen, Dick, I'm going to be the first one to admit that when I went and did a lot of study, they threw formulas at me and things at me, and a lot of the stuff I just... Yes, I always made notes. I always, kept my books. I still got all my books and everything like that in order. But a lot of the stuff I used to say to myself, who needs all this stuff? And also, tell me how to make a buck. What do I got to know to make a living? And then later on, when I ran into a number of different problems, and I look back at it now, I said, oh, this is what this was for. So, you know, it's good to really learn. And put it in the back of your mind. So even though you may not go to the Smith chart every single day of the week, unless you're involved with, you know, doing antenna work and matching or whatever, lines, things, you know, different reasons that you have to look at complex, you know, matching and all, it's still good to learn. And if, you know, a number of these sites, Dick, I have tried a number of these sites. I have had a bit of problem. Maybe I'm not as computer savvy as I should be, but I have used a number of the LNEC and NEC programs and all, you know, antenna modeling, and a number of times I didn't get the results that I expected. I wonder, if, first of all, if you've had an experience with them, Dick, over.
Unfortunately, the answer is no. Lots and lots of people have asked me, hey, you're in the antenna designing business. How often have you used MiniNEC, LNEC, and all those modeling programs? And the answer is zero. I do it by the hard way. In other words, I build physical models. I do some computer modeling when it comes to figuring out how to match a measured impedance of an antenna to the real transmission system I'm using. There I'll do some modeling. But the basic modeling of the antenna itself, people like Steve Polish and K1FO have gone very heavily into that, and he's done it with elaborate structures, you know, 30-element Yagi designs, and managed to peak up the gain of the pattern adjust the side lobes, the front-to-back ratio, and the frequency bandwidth, and so on. And I know that those programs, properly used, are very valuable tools. However, Steve will admit to you, you take the latest version of the best of the best of those modeling programs on a good medium-long Yagi antenna, and you tweak and tweak, and it finds all kinds of good solutions for
long-winded repeater time out 0 seconds.
It'll find all kinds of good solutions for you. It gets you into the ballpark. It gets you onto the approximate center of the playing field. But it does not get you to home plate all the time, most of the time. It doesn't get you there. It gets you close. But you still have to do post-computer optimization, PCO. So the best electronic modeling programs are, they don't go quite deep enough, so to speak. They don't go down to the molecular level. Mother Nature's got a couple of surprises for us all the time. So he's found it a valuable tool, but it's not perfect. He still does PCO after that. Back to you, Mel.
That's what I figured, because I've got similar problems with this. A number of these programs I've tried to work with, and here I am sitting here now with a compass and a ruler back again, doing it by, my daughter called me the dinosaur. She said, I'm surprised you don't chisel it in stone sometimes. But the point is that I seem to be able to, I guess, visualize it better when I put it on a piece of paper than I see it on a screen. All right, well, anyway, getting back to, the loop antenna situation. The other day I was on 20 meter CW. Band was pretty good. Some nice, great DX coming through from Asia and all, and had a nice couple nice contacts. And then I said, gee, let me take a look, see if anything's doing on 15 meters, 10, 15, and so on and so forth. Nothing much, so I then moved up to 30 meters. And on 30 meters, yes, good old 30 meters seem to be pretty lively. And I have, for 30 meters, I have an inverted V antenna, which I have backed up there for a number of years and still works, so it doesn't take up much room and all, and sort of out of the way, and so I leave it, and I made a few contacts on 30 meters. I then decide, you know, what about this loop? I put this loop on 30 meters and see what happens. Let me let it drop. Well, anyhow, I tried to load the loop up. Well, I didn't load it up. I should put the AEA antenna analyzer on the tuner, on the Johnson Kilowatt Matchbox, and I tried all kinds of combinations and all, and I saw an SWR is ridiculous. 8, 9 to 1 or whatever. I think it goes to the 10 to 1 and goes off screen. So I said, I don't think I can do much with this thing on 30 meters. However, the articles, they said you can have the loop bliss with the loop. Your antenna bliss will come with the loop antenna. If you want to use it above 40 meters to feed it, take two feed lines, 600 ohm feed line, put them together to the tuner, put the other balanced input of the tuner to a good ground system, and I emphasize a good ground system, and you'll have yourself a vertically loaded loop. In other words, it becomes, I guess, the feed line. That's why they emphasize dropping the feed line straight down and all kinds of reasons for it. And here you have a top-loaded vertical antenna, supposedly. Let me let it drop. Well, anyhow, I did that, loaded, it worked, made some nice contacts, listening around, seemed to be pretty good antenna and all. Now, here's the point. Without getting into kilobucks, is there any way that with, I could go directly to the 600 ohm feed line and make some kind of measurements? How can you think of some way? And again, don't start telling me about a 45 grand network analyzer or something. The budget, I'm getting a look already from the XYO. Don't worry, I'm not buying it. Or something of that sort. Is there any way you can think of that I could actually go to the 600 ohm line and really do some real measurements, Dick? Go ahead.
Absolutely. Let me let it drop. Yes, you definitely can do that, Mel. I think you own an AEA antenna analyzer, which is made for a 50-ohm environment. If you then built yourself or bought, for a very inexpensive amount of money, a 50-ohm to 600-ohm balancing device, you can go to the right Jerry Civic W2FMI article. He will teach you how to wind one on a toroid. Let's assume now you're doing it for the 30-meter region, 10-megacycle region. You pick up the right kind of toroid material that has high efficiency at 10 megacycles, and it's probably a number of choices. You wind the wires on there the right way, bifolar, trifolar, and whatever, so that it becomes a 50-ohm to 600-ohm converting balance, where it converts from 50-ohm unbalance to 600-ohm balance. Stand by. And you calibrate it by putting a 600-ohm low inductance resistor on its output and measure what your antenna analyzer says. Hopefully your antenna analyzer will say it is something like a 1.15 standing wave ratio at a particular phase angle. You then also put a short and an open on the output of the balun. With those three pieces of information, what impedance you get on your AEA antenna analyzer, when going into that balancing device with a short and open and a 600 ohm resistor, and maybe you'll find out that a 630 ohm resistor makes it perfect, or a 630 ohm resistor with a 2 picofarad capacitor makes a perfect load. With that raw information, you have now characterized your testing setup. You have now theoretically moved that 600 ohm balancing device. You have now moved it inside of your AEA analyzer. Put a great big box around the whole thing if you want, and you can now call it a 610 ohm impedance balanced antenna analyzer. Now you put your real antenna on there, where you write down what values you get on the AEA antenna analyzer with your real antenna at your various frequencies, compare that properly with the calibration you did with the short, open, and the 600 ohm resistor, and you've got it all. And that balancing device added to your AEA analyzer, I bet you can do that for $10. Back to you, Mel.
Okay, I wonder if that would really work. Now, what do I do, like, for instance, if I want to model it? Would I use, what would I use it? Would I normalize it at 600 ohms, or would I normalize it at 50 over?
I think you would set up your Smith chart for 600 ohms. If I've got that right, yes. You've now, with that added balancing device, you have now converted your AEA from 50 ohms unbalanced to 600 ohm balanced. And what every network analyzer does, it doesn't matter if your network analyzer is a 10 ohm network analyzer, a 50 ohm network analyzer balanced or unbalanced, or a 600 ohm network analyzer. In all cases, the network analyzer measures reflection voltage ratio, and your ratio is with reference to 600 ohms. Doesn't matter. Reflectance voltage ratio, you want to know, is half the voltage you send out coming back, or is one-tenth of the voltage, one-tenth of 1% of the voltage you send out coming back. That combined with the phase angle tells you everything you want to know. So reflection voltage ratio is what S11 really is, and that's what a Smith chart really is, reflection voltage ratio. When you pick up that piece of Smith chart, it does not say 50 ohms on it. You can write on it 10 ohms or 600 ohms, whatever you're working with, and the Smith chart works from there. You've got it made, Mel. A little bit of calibration requirement. In other words, when you make your measurements on your 600 ohm open line, and you get a certain reflection voltage characteristic and a certain phase angle. Say, for instance, you've got a pretty high vis one, a 3-to-1, and you find out that half the voltage is coming back. That you send out reflection voltage characteristic of 0.5 as a voltage ratio. And you measure 10 degrees. And because of the calibration you did on your balancing device that you wound under the toroid, If you get the correction, maybe the 0.5 voltage coming back is really 0.52, and the 10 degrees is really 11 degrees. Your calibration allows you to make that correction. Even if you didn't make the correction, you're close enough to get the data you're looking for. So with a little bit of things you can wind with your hands, you're going to have a 600 ohm balanced AEA antenna tuner in your hand. And when you do, it's time you write an article so that you don't keep that bright light under the bushel basket and you spread that great information to other amateurs. K2KEY, wait for the beep. K2RIW in the TechNet.
Comment to Leo.
And
long-winded. Repeater, time out, 0 seconds.
Mel, Rich, and another person in that order. Mel first, go ahead.
Okay. I get what you I understand 100% what you were trying to do. In other words, I am going to use as, in other words, I'm going to really translate what I'm getting on the 600 ohm line and actually translate it down to a 50 ohm reading type device, like you say, the AEA is set up for reading at 50 ohms. So now when I put it on the Smith chart, I am going to use as the prime center, I'm going to use a 50 ohm reference, and then whatever I get will reflect back at the same rate you're telling me as it would be at a 600 ohms. But in other words, I'll do all my triangulation on the Smith chart, all my noting on the Smith chart, based on 50 ohms as the prime center. Am I correct, over?
There's a partial yes to that, Mel. You could choose to do it that way, but you're one step back from your calibration procedure. I'm recommending that you wind and test a couple of times until you get it just right, the 600 ohm balancing device. 50 ohms unbalanced in, the 600 ohm balanced out. With a little bit of care, you can make that 98% accurate, in my opinion. From then on, you could, if you want to, put a box around that whole setup where from the front panel you look at the AEA front panel. But the two wires coming out of the back of this new box are 600 ohm twin lead. All your answers will be referenced to 600 ohms. You could, if you want to, decide to make the Smith chart a 600 ohm Smith chart because that's where the answers are really happening. If you get a reflection coefficient of 0.5, which is a 3-to-1 fading wave ratio, at an angle of 10 degrees, which represents a certain amount of reactance, and you plot that on your Smith chart, that will be telling you answers directly in your real transmission line and your real antenna system. That's where you're operating. In the 600 ohm world, you want to know, is your 600 ohm transmission line, because of the way the antenna is acting, let me drop. You want to know, is your 600 ohm transmission line acting like 680 ohms? And is it acting like it's got 20 ohms of capacitor reactance in series with it on the 600 ohm line? So you have the ability to do it either way. My recommendation is you flip the whole world. You're going to calibrate at 600 ohms. You're going to measure at 600 ohms. Therefore, I'm recommending you set up your Smith chart right across the top of the Smith chart. This is a 600 ohm Smith chart. And all your answers will be in the real world of where you're making the measurements, where the antenna really is. And when you know how many ohms of capacitive reactance you've got on the 600 ohm line, that'll tell you directly what your antenna is doing once you know the length of your 600 ohm open line. You could do it your way if you want to, Mel. Just because you and I are so familiar with 50 ohms, it's very tempting. You are not forced to do that. You are building a 600 ohm testing machine. You could put a box around it and call it a 600 ohm AEA equivalent by the KEY technique and write the article accordingly. Mel first. Go ahead, Mel.
In other words, I've got to find now a transformer, a method of making a transformer that will go from 50 ohms to 600 ohms And then, like you say, do all the testing of it, primarily first with a 600 ohm non-inductive resistance for calibration, open, short, and then I say, again, a resistance of some sort set up to get my third measurement on it to give me the three calibration points. And then you say to work at 600 ohms and then try to, I was thinking of working at 50 ohms and then, you know, trying to say, okay, whatever I see then at 50 ohms on the, whatever I, you know, actually track on the 50 ohms is just a reflection of what I'm seeing on the 600 ohms. Because, again, you're right, I'm more used to working with a Smith chart at 50 ohms, Dick, over.
I understand that. But Mr. Smith designed a chart that has no magic about 50. So the people who use his chart in Europe, where 70 ohms is the standard, they assumed Mr. Smith designed that chart for 70 ohms. You and I live in the 50 ohm world, and we think Mr. Smith designed it for 50 ohms. If you're worrying about how well your transmitter is going to act and how well your normal 50 ohm antenna tuner is going to work, yes, you could do it from the 50 ohm point of view. But if you're studying the antenna itself and you want to know what the antenna is doing, I see a lot of advantage in you making it a 600 ohm Smith chart. You can do it either way. And once you've got the calibration of short, open, and 600 ohms on your balancing device, you are both measuring the quality of your balancing device, and it tells you how to do the next step of correction if you want the answer to be more accurate. I don't think you need it, but it's nice to know it's all there. Okay, Rich and another person in that order. N2EO, go ahead, Rich, with your comment. K2RIW in the TechNet, please wait for the beep.
Okay, Dick. Two items I was going to suggest that MFJ make. First of all, they make something called a W9 INN talent box. It converts 50 ohms to, I guess, 600 ohm ladder line for $20. MFJ is also now making a dual scale RF amp meter for open wireline. That's you, Dick.
So once again, did you say AEA makes this balancing box for $20? Is that what you said?
AEA MFJ is making something called the W9 INN balancing box at $18-$19.
Go ahead, Doc. Okay, let me get the beep here.
Now I downloaded that Smith chart that you mentioned, the Black Magic. Very, very good. You're right. It's clear as anything. Came out great on my printer. Just wanted to make that comment. Thanks for that. I tried doing that one other time, and it wasn't that clear with another site, so just came out great.
Yeah, I think the best one goes over to a Adobe Acrobat. Very nice, clear printing. You got it, Mel.
That's where this came from, Dick.
Hey, next, Scott, it's say that the one in PDF form is the one that's really, really very distinct. Yeah, very good, Dick. Well, that's it. I'm going to see if I look into, I want, like you say, look into maybe something put together myself, you know, a transformer like that, so I can juggle around if worse comes to worse, you know, because the MFJ, it's basically, you know, what he's selling. He's selling a number of these tuners that you buy now. All of a sudden, there's been a great interest in open wire feeders of late, you know, using 300 ohm ribbon cable and all these different things. All of a sudden, 400 ohm, 450 ohm cable has been all of a sudden on market again. And there seems to be, you know, a lot of people that are all of a sudden are revisiting open wire feeders. So a number of the tuners that are coming out now have a balanced you know, feed at the back. They're two insulators that poke through the back of the cabinet for balanced, you know, wire input. And basically, I just stick a balun in there, which I'm very familiar with. I got the balun because I once made one up, something similar to that. And I'm just thinking about it, and I think I'm going to resurrect that balun, see what happens, take over.
Okay, sounds good. Good luck with that project. And you've got quite a few choices there. And once you already own the AEA antenna analyzer, you've got it made. That is a slightly less expensive network analyzer. If it can measure amplitude of the voltage coming back and the phase angle, that's almost all the raw data you want. KF2, Tango Papa, please start off with your name, sir, and then proceed with your question. My name is Dick.
Thank you, Dick. K2RIW in the net. This is Rick. I have a question for you real quick. I know it's getting late. I don't want to hold everybody up. But I have a question for you. What's old is new. There seems to be some interest in the 600-meter band coming through the ARRL through W1FR and also the Radio Society of Great Britain. There's interest in this band in that what they're saying is the 600-meter ultra-reliable regional ground wave communication, which is not subject to interruption by solar storms. They're basically talking about this as a communication vehicle for emergencies, and I'm just wondering, you know, if this is true. They're talking about communication between 60 and 200 miles, up to 1,500 miles over salt water under ideal conditions, using a 42-foot vertical antenna. Do you have any experience with this? Do these claims seem to be realistic? Back to you.
Once again, repeat that one, Rick. How many foot antenna?
You're talking about a 42-foot vertical. Back to you.
Wow. Okay, the 600-meter band, the half-wave dipole, would be almost 1,000 feet long. A quarter wave would be, 600, 300, 1,000 feet, half-wave, 500 feet for quarter wave. So your 42-foot antenna is 1/50th of a wavelength, so to speak. That's going to be a lot of inductive loading on the antenna. Very high Q. Although with the right kind of a ground plane structure, that can work. Not sure if it's going to give you quite the low angle of radiation you'd like, but as you go down in frequency, let me drop, you rapidly get to the point where you're never below the MUF, the maximum usable frequency. You're always below the maximum usable frequency. The ionosphere is always there for you. The only thing you're going to worry about is that during the daytime you're going to get 6 significant amount of D-layer absorption at high noon. And I presume that that still takes place at those frequencies. But at nighttime, I think that's going to shine. Yes, I think that can work. And the equipment to build it, if you home brew it, doesn't have to be super expensive. A 600-meter transmitter made out of transistors is a relatively easy thing to do. I think you only allowed a few watts of power on that band, so again, it suggests that a solid-state transmitter, and you even have the ability to make it battery-operated. So the biggest requirement, as I see it, is for the ground plane structure on that 42-foot antenna. If it is, let me drop, if it is a quarter-wave ground plane type, and for a bunch of reasons, yeah, I guess it would have to be. If you built it as a half-wave horizontally polarized antenna, you would have an extremely high angle of radiation. It would be a NVIRS antenna, near vertical incident radiation system. Straight, it squirts the signal straight up and not very far out for very long range. So I suspect that as it is right now, the longest wavelength that hams use with any popularity is the 160-meter band, 1.8 megacycles. And the 160-band people, they call themselves the top banders. Well, it's the top band in wavelength, it's the bottom band when you talk about frequency. And now with the 600 meters, there's a brand new definition of the top banders. So it could be a fun thing to experiment with, and it may not require a whole lot of money. So maybe it's right up your alley, Rick. I don't have direct experience with it, as you can tell. I suspect not too many of the people on the TechNet do yet. But maybe you're going to be the harbinger of the new band here for us. KF2, Tango Papa, K2RIW on the TechNet.
Comment, Dick.
Stand by a minute, Rick. Go ahead, Doc Bell.
All right. Well, one of the articles on it, I sent, you catch my eye, they wound a coil with a base. And the coil looks like it's about, I don't know, about 3 feet or something in diameter. A real big coil. They had stood about, I think, maybe 3-4 feet high and maybe about 3 feet in diameter as the base coil over.
Now, when it comes to these super low frequency antennas, winding a coil to make it the amateur radio equivalent of a loop stick, an H-field sensing antenna, for receiving, that's easy. Transmitting is a little bit more difficult. A good transmitting antenna on this band is going to require a fairly large loading coil. That's not expensive, not too difficult to do. The 42-foot radiator, that requires a little bit of mechanical engineering, but that's doable. It's going to also require a pretty extensive ground plane radial system in order to get high efficiency out of the antenna. And maybe there's a way you can compromise there. If you're using a deficient ground plane radiating system, and if you could prove, hands down to the FCC, that your antenna has only 5% of radiation efficiency, that 95% of the power is being eaten up by heating up the soil in your backyard. So if your antenna is 5%, 1/20th of the full efficiency, and if you could confirm that to the FCC, and if you're allowed 1 watt on that band, with that measurement, you may be allowed to transmit 20 watts into it, just as long as you're only radiating 1 watt. And maybe you can get around putting in this very extensive ground plane radiation system. I think there's a possibility there. KF2TP, K2RIW TechNet, wait for the beep.
K2RIW and the group, this is KF2TP. You're right on target, Dick. The FCC approved to WD2XSH approval to run 20 watts experimentally on the 600 meter band, you know, to see what that can be done. This is the traditional maritime emergency frequency. It's nothing new. What's new is old. What's old is new. And it became new again. What caught my eye is what they call ultra-reliable regional ground wave communication, which is independent of ionospheric interference. And this can be used in conjunction with emergency communication using the repeaters, of course. And it would be interesting for any CW operator to be able to work the local guys. So that's what caught my attention, and I just wanted to see what you thought about it as far as, you know, communication viability within, 200-mile radius. Back to you, Dick.
Sounds good to me, Rick. I think you could have some fun with it. And you would be going on to a rather new band that is not yet crowded. You'd own the band, so to speak. We're going to borrow that frequency from Tango Popper, and he's going to loan it to us from time to time. Making jokes a little bit, but you know what I'm saying. So it's one way to get away from all the QR Nancy and QR Mary in particular, from, say, the 40 and 20 and 15 meter band. When the bands are open, they're awfully crowded. So I think you could have fun with it. You can experiment with transmitting techniques, receiving antenna techniques. My guess is during the thunderstorm, you're going to hear some static crashes. You probably will want to have a fairly good noise blanker. And there are very good solid-state noise blankers that have been invented these days. You put it all together just right, it could be a pretty nice system for a CW operator. I think speech is not allowed there yet, but it may be someday. So let us know how your research works in that area, Rick, and come back from time to time and tell us how you're progressing and what you're doing with it. It's a little bit different than what the rest of us are doing. You're thinking out of the box, as they say, out of the normal 80 through 10 meters or 160 through 10 meters. Let me drop. Should be fine. Okay. Have we gone through all the subjects that everyone wants to discuss tonight? Is that it? And if so, if we had a whole lot of time left over, I was going to discuss a little bit more about this EH antenna. I think I'll study this report that was mailed to me by Bennett, and I'll go into it a little bit deeper next week. Awful nice big report. And I can tell the writer is quite sincere about it, but so it's a little controversial, and I've got a couple of problems. It violates a couple of the concepts that I hold near and dear, but let's face it. The models that we build in our head fit the data that we're familiar with. And just because it fits doesn't mean it's 100% accurate. Everything we know that's called science is slowly changing, slowly evolving. Today's theory is good enough for today. It'll be a little bit antique as a theory tomorrow, when we know a little bit more information. So let me drop. A lot of people would like to believe that the word science is an exact set of answers. It's not. It's an evolving body of knowledge that's continuously changing. In general, it's continuously becoming more refined. Whatever theory you've got doesn't really become accepted. It doesn't pass peer review until somebody else in some other laboratory takes your measurement procedure, duplicates it with his hardware, and maybe his slight different spin on the way he makes the measurement. And if he comes up with a similar answer, he gives you a confirmation. If he comes up with a very different answer, he gives you a challenge to your concept. And in theory, if he's a good scientist, he writes a letter to you saying, "Hey, Dick, I made this measurement. I got a very different answer. I used a slightly different piece of apparatus, but it should have given the same answer. Have you got an explanation for that?" And you guys toss it back and forth, and eventually you find out what's going on. That's what science is. Mother Nature never promised that any of this jazz is going to be simple and easiest to understand. You could say all she promised is that it's going to be challenging, and it's not going to be simple. If you think it's simple, you don't understand the problem. Nothing is simple. The psychologists out there can say, "Hey, you engineers, you make everything complicated." Well, they can sit back on their easy chair, and they can make that statement, and they can make a good buck selling that concept of theirs. It ain't accurate. It ain't the real world. The real world's complicated. You gotta accept that. 73, you all. Be kind to each other. Anybody else got any closing comments before we slow down tonight?
One comment, PNJ.
Go ahead. My goodness, why can't I find... Yes, go ahead, sir.
Where's George Fox these days?
The last I knew, he was the general manager of the Deer Park division of AIO/EDO, the EDO subsidiary of the AIO subsidiary of EDO. I don't know whether or not, when they closed down the Deer Park plant, whether or not he moved over to the Amityville plant of EDO. I suspect he did. That's quite possibly where he is. If he is still employed and he hasn't retired, he and I were fairly similar in age. Most likely he has fully retired by now, and he's living out on the South Fork. He has a home out on the South Fork that you may or may not know about. And so either that, or if he's working part-time, he would be working in the Amityville plant of EDO. Thank you, sir.
Okay, thank you so much. Good night tonight. Look forward to it.
Repeater, time out, 0 seconds.
Very fine, Bob. Thank you for bringing that Ramcore story to us and Spectrum Microwave. I bought some nice waveguide switches from Spectrum Microwave. And I guess I wasn't smart enough to know that their parent company was Ramcore. And Vic Nelson did all that work. And that super high power switch that they had to build for Voice of America, that's a heavy challenge. I imagine no matter what RF mavens were on site, I bet you guys wished you had a little bit more high-power RF knowledge when you were designing that switch. The specifications on that switch must have been a little bit difficult to live with. Am I approximately right, Bob?
Yeah, you're 100% right. Not only that, the test equipment that we jury-rigged together, we had to use a lot of RTV silicone to keep the arcing down.
That must have been a beauty. Refresh, push for me. How many watts was that thing running? Was it something like 50,000 watts?
Something around that. I don't remember. I couldn't tell you what I had for breakfast yesterday, let alone going back 35, 40 years. But it was so exciting to go to work these days, working on such things.
How big was the physical piece of hardware that you guys were turning out?
I would say it was about 4 foot square by about seven foot high.
Wow. And that was a waveguide or coax? That was a coax switch, is that true?
Yeah, it had two center conductors.
Fantastic. And some kind of a great big mover, a great big motor that moved the armature from one to the other?
Yeah, it had like a worm drive, and it raised the transfer assembly into a set of vertical fingers in a locked exact position. Quite ingenious.
W2VL repeater.
I'd like to know, Bob, do you have a set of pictures on that switch? If so, when it comes to the Ham Radio University, that's going to be held in January, the beginning of January of next year, it would be a lot of fun for you to bring down those pictures and show them to people. That's a serious coax TR relay, transmit receive relay. I hope you have a set of pictures of that. Is that true, Bob?
Negative on that. I have nothing on that. There was another hand that worked with us. His name was Bob Manson. I can't remember his call, but he worked on that unit with us.
I know Bob Manson very well. He and I went to the same high school together, Port Jefferson High School. And so Bob Benson worked on, I'm having trouble remembering Bob Benson's call letters right now. But, so you believe Bob Benson might have a set of pictures on that?
Yes, it's amazing. We just did the library over at Port Jefferson High School on the electrical end of my business.
Yeah, I think Bob is now serving as a financial advisor. He's got a website along those lines. He and I went to the same school together, and we're comparing electrical notes at the time. We were both members of the Port Jefferson High School Amateur Radio Club way back in the dark ages. I won't tell you how many years ago that one was, Paul, Chris and Bob. So Bob Benson worked there at the same time. You have fairly good knowledge that he does have pictures, or you're guessing that he might have pictures? Back to you, Bob.
It's a good possibility that he has some of that paperwork. I want to tell you, the world got real small tonight, Dick.
Sure did. Everybody you mentioned, I know. Mention somebody else who worked there, particularly if it was a ham.
Well, you know Vic Nelson. How about Carl Solomon or, what's his name? Who else? Mel Seidman was another engineer. Mel opened up a dip raising shop on Industry Court West, where Vic's place is on Industry Court. He's on that Horseshoe Street Industry Court, and Vic's was on the corner of Grand and Industry Court, I guess it's West. And Mel Seidman had the place on the north end of the court.
And that Industry Court was right around the corner from AIO's Deer Park plant. Boy, were we close together. In fact, during the height of the B-1B program, 1985, AIO had a plant, had two buildings on Industry Court. One of them was for storage of data, and the other one was the instrumentation department. Right at the top of the Horseshoe on Industry Court was a building that AIO was inventing for their instrumentation and calibration shop. Boy, were we close together. Interesting. Thank you for any of the comments on this, Bob.
Another two engineers, Val Bell was one and Rudy Scherer was another. Did you know those two fellas?
No, sorry, I don't. Rudy Scherer and Val Bell. Nope. Those are new ones on me.
We'll pick this conversation up again when it's a little earlier. Take care. Have a good night. W2PNJ clear.
Very good, Bob. Thank you for checking in. Rich, you wanted to make another comment? And 2EO?
I was just commenting that when Voice of America went off, they really did pull the big switch.
Oh boy. Yep. Maybe they pulled the big Ramcore switch. We amateurs always sign off by pulling the big switch. Back in the days when there used to be a great big knife switch on the wall, a double knife switch that took your 600 ohm line and opened it up so that the lightning hit it wouldn't damage your equipment. That was one of the big switches. And I guess sometimes it was a great big circuit breaker that turned off all the 110 volts to all your equipment. Okay. We intend to go further forward with all this either antique or super modern electronics next week. 73 you all. Bye-bye for now. KQLIW, TechNet Landmark, we're clear.
And before you go, Dick, I have a question.
Go right ahead.
Last week we were discussing the stubs and trying to cancel out second harmonics. And I think I sent you an email on that. What were you actually thinking? The open half-wave stub doesn't work.
Hold on now. If you make a quarter-wave shorted stub on the fundamental frequency, it does become, by definition, a half-wave shorted stub on the second harmonic. That's what we were talking about last week. That will give you rejection of second harmonic. Now, you're asking, and you gave me an email with reference to open circuit stubs. Can we do it with open circuit? An open circuit quarter wave, unfortunately, would be a short at the fundamental. If you made it an open circuit quarter wave at the second harmonic, just like you were showing me, it would be an eighth wave on the fundamental. It would therefore be reactive. You could tune it out, and you could use that as a method of rejecting second harmonic. It wouldn't be the nicest way to do it. The nicest way to do it is a quarter wave, shorted stub on the fundamental. Back to you, Rich.
Okay, Steve. But I thought you were saying, and part of the reason I was arguing was that you wanted to use a half wave open stub at the fundamental. Maybe I misunderstood.
Yeah, I either said it wrong, or maybe I was saying that a quarter wave shorted on fundamental acts like a open circuit on the second harmonic. I got it backwards. It's an open circuit on the fundamental. It acts like a short circuit on the second harmonic. And I was simultaneously combining that, saying that you might want to do it by half-wave techniques, because another quarter wave into an open circuit is the nicest way to make a short circuit. If you did that on the fundamental, let me think about that. I think it would not work. On the second harmonic, it would be full wave. It would be an open circuit again. Nope. It looks like you've really got to make a short-circuited quarter wave stub on fundamental to do this most easily. there's other ways of doing it, but that's the way to do it most easily. And then if you need more rejection than that,